Today I decided to go through sutta number 70. I've got a whole list of the suttas we've already talked about, and this was not on it. So I decided to talk about Kitagiri Sutta today. And it does have a couple of interesting points on it. Perhaps the most salient point on this particular sutta is it's talking about bad monks. Because usually, you know, we like to talk about the good monks and, you know, the inspiring examples and monks who do really good things. But like in any community, you'll always have a few scallywags. And this is about two of those scallywags. For those of you who read widely the Buddhist scriptures, there was a group of monks called the Group of Six Monks. And those Group of Six Monks got up to all types of mischief, including, this is in the Vinaya, including one of the things they did. They got hold of this group of 17 monks, who were very young and immature, and they got hold of one of them. And this is the story 2,600 years ago. They got hold of him and started tickling him. And he was laughing so much he couldn't catch his breath, and he died. And because of that, there's one of the 227 rules for a Buddhist monk is we're not allowed to tickle each other. So, you know, it's okay, some serious stuff in there, like not killing animals, but there's also some fun stuff as well. And that was these couple of monks I'm going to mention here. These were two of those group of six monks. And you can imagine that after a while they all disrobed and they left. Because sometimes in those days, when Buddhism was becoming popular, it was very nice to be a monk. It's an easy life for some. And so they just became monks, but they weren't really interested in meditating or becoming enlightened. And this is the story about a couple of those. And it's also a story of the different stages of enlightenment, which is people would love to know, the different stages, but not in terms of the usual four stages, the stream winner, once return, and non-return, and arahat, in terms of another way of looking at the path towards enlightenment. And lastly in here, this sutta is often quoted for the two types of ways to become enlightened. And it's often misquoted as if there can be enlightenment without the jhanas. And I'm going to point this out as we come here. And it's quite clear, if you look at it, what it actually says rather than what you want to see, it's quite clear that you still need the jhanas to become enlightened. So that's the Kitagiri Sutta. Those are the two or three main points which come up. So now, if everyone wishes to find a nice seat, and we can begin with the Kitagiri Sutta. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammang sanghang namassami. Have you got any more copies of the... Oh, gone. Okay. So, well, you can just listen as we go. It should be quite clear to you. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kasi country together with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and there he addressed the bhikkhus thus. And the Kasi country was, they say, just to the upper reaches of the Ganges Valley. Now, not sort of too far south of Delhi, so around that area, a little bit away from the central part of where Buddhism was being, where Buddhism was being propagated. Bhikkhus, said the Buddha, I abstain from eating at night. By so doing, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, monks. Abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. And yes, Venerable Sir, they replied. So this is one of the very obvious rules which you know for Buddhist monks, because you, the people who have to feed us. So there's some of the rules you don't know, but this is one which everybody knows as a lay person, because monks aren't supposed to eat at night or in the afternoon. Yes, Venerable Sir, they replied. Then, as the Blessed One was wandering by stages in the Kasi country, he eventually arrived at a Kasi town called Kitagiri. And Giri means hill, so it must be Kita Hill.
There he lived in this Kasi town, Kitagiri. Now on that occasion, the bhikkhus, the monks named Asaji and Punabasuka, were residing at Kitagiri, and those were two of the group of six monks. Then a number of monks went and told them, "Friends, the Blessed One," that's the Buddha, "and the Sangha of bhikkhus now abstain from eating at night. By so doing, they are free from illness and affliction, and they enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, friends," saying to Asaju and Punabasuku, "come, friends, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding." When this was said, the monks Asaji and Punabasuka told those monks, "Friends, we eat in the evening, in the morning, and in a day, outside any time. By so doing, we are free from illness and affliction, and we enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and a day, outside the proper time." So they weren't very easy to teach. So since those monks were unable to convince these two of the group of six monks, Asaji and Punabasuka, they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told them all that occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, since we were unable to convince the bhikkhus, Asaji and Punabasuka, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." So it's okay to report matters about what happens, because it's not out of ill will. You're not trying to get these monks into trouble. You're just saying, look, you know, we want to make sure there's a bit of peace and harmony in the Sangha, and you know, there is a problem here. So it's okay to have tale-bearing if it is with a good heart. But if it's some malice there, then please don't gossip. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk thus, "Come, monk, tell the bhikkhus, Asaji and Punabasuka, in my name, that the teacher calls them." "Yes, venerable sir," he replied. And he went to the bhikkhus, Asaji and Punabasuka, and told them, "The teacher calls you, friends." "Yes, friend," they replied. And they went to the Blessed One, the Buddha, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then said, "Bhikkhus, is it true that when a number of bhikkhus went and told you, 'Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha now abstain from eating at night. Come, friends, abstain from eating at night.' You told those monks, 'Friends, we eat in the evening. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day, outside the proper time.' Is that true?" "Yes, venerable sir." And this was always the case in the Buddhist Sangha. Even if you had reports, you know, which sounded believable, credible, you wouldn't just believe it. You'd go and ask the person, first of all, now, is that true? Did that really happen? Because sometimes people just misunderstand. So it's always the case in Buddhism. If someone has done something wrong, or there's some report, or there's some gossip going around, you just ask them, is that true? And whatever they say, that's what you believe. But you don't just go on gossip. Because you know what gossip does? It just creates all sorts of misunderstandings, hurt and schisms and all sorts of stuff. And the Buddha replied, "Monks, have you known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Whatever this person experiences, pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, whatever they experience, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase." Now this is the point here. The Buddha is saying the whole purpose of this is the good states, the wholesome states, the states of peace, of kindness, of freedom from sort of affliction. If those wholesome states increase, that's the path. If the unwholesome states, such as anger, depression, fear, lust, craving, all those unwholesome states, if they increase, that's going on the opposite path. That's not the way to practice. So do these wholesome states, these good states, like, you know, peace and freedom and compassion, fearlessness, you know, how do they grow? And if they diminish, why do they diminish? Is it just because anything you experience? It's no, venerable sir. "Monks, have you not known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way? Here when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish." In other words, it's the wrong type of pleasant feeling. But when someone feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase. So it's not just because it's a pleasurable feeling that you have to avoid all pleasurable feelings. There are some pleasurable feelings which give rise to more peace, more kindness, more serenity, more fearlessness, and other types of pleasant feeling give rise to more craving, sort of more anger, and all sorts of other stuff. So, who can give me some examples of pleasant feelings which increase craving, fear, suffering? Ah, come on. I need some feedback now. Yes? Drinking alcohol. That's a good one. Is it pleasant to drink alcohol? It must be, otherwise no one would do it. Like cocaine, it must be pleasant. You know, driving fast cars must be pleasant. But does it give rise to unhappy feeling, wholesome states or unwholesome states? Watching the cricket, watching the soccer, watching the footy, that must be pleasurable because that people actually pay to do it. But does that give rise to wholesome feelings or unwholesome feelings? I've heard that if you're watching Australia, it usually gives rise to unwholesome feelings of depression and sadness and anger. So there's many sort of which gives rise to unwholesome results. What type of, this is a great question now, what type of pleasurable feelings give rise to wholesome states, good states, where you are making progress in the Dhamma? Meditation, if you know how to meditate correctly, yes. Gratitude, yeah. Listening to the Dhamma, going to the monasteries, becoming a member of the Buddhist Society of WA Committee, that gives rise to many wholesome states. Maybe that should be, here when someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, wholesome states increase. I think they might be joining the committee. But just because it's a pleasurable feeling, it doesn't mean it's not going to arouse wholesome, progressive states on your spiritual path. Because many people feel if it's pleasurable, it must be bad for you. Someone once told me that Puritanism, the definition of Puritanism, is the fear that somewhere, someplace, someone is happy. And that was actually the Middle Age spirituality. You know, if it's pleasurable, it must be bad for you. And the Buddha was more careful. Some pleasures are good for you. Some pleasures are bad for your spiritual path. So know the difference between the two. Inspiration. You know, like the joy of giving dana. Yeah, you really get off on that. But that's a good thing to get off on. And so visiting the holy sites in India, I really get off on that. And that's great pleasure. But that is something which increases the wholesome states. So there's a powerful point in there. Just because it's pleasurable doesn't mean it's good or bad. Some are good, some are bad. Find the difference. And it carries on. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states increase and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states diminish and unwholesome states increase. So sometimes the painful feelings are actually good for you. Sometimes they're bad for you. So what type of painful feeling is good for you? I've already mentioned joining the committee of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Or just enjoying a little bit of pain in the beginning of a meditation. Or, you know, coming to a sutta class when it's really hot. Yeah, it's a painful feeling because it's unpleasant, but nevertheless, you know, you learn a lot of good things. And of course, we all know many painful feelings which are bad for you, which is, you know, forcing the body like the Buddha did for 6 years, you know, just trying to train the body just through your will until you hurt the body and harm it, which is what we call asceticism. So again, in the Middle Ages, especially the Christian monasticism, think if it hurt, it must be good for you. Which is why they really got into asceticism. The Buddha said, well, asceticism, just because it hurts, it doesn't mean it's good. Just because it's painful, doesn't mean you're going to get somewhere. So if wholesome states increase, I mentioned the wholesome states of peace, wisdom, kindness, gentleness, stillness. If those increase, then it's worth it. If those are decreasing, it's not worth it. So it's a good little reminder for you. If you're meditating and something's aching in you or hurting, ask yourself, if I continue like this, are wholesome states going to increase or are they going to decrease? If they're going to increase, carry on sitting. If they're going to decrease, move. This is what the Buddha's saying here. And we got here, when someone feels a certain kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase. So who knows a neither pleasant nor painful feeling in which unwholesome states usually increase? That's neither painful nor pleasant, not feeling anything. You're dulled out. That was, you might call that sort of where unwholesome states increase. Who knows a neither painful nor pleasant feeling where wholesome states increase? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So in the jhanas, when you're in deep meditation. But anyway, you get the idea here. That it's not just because it's painful or pleasure or somewhere in between. It's whether it's going to be useful and productive, whether these things called wholesome states are increasing or they're not increasing. And actually, so on Friday night, when Lawrence said about the message in front of the Buddha statue there, the Sabbapapasara Karanang, where it says, "Do no evil but do good, purify the mind, the teaching of the Buddha." Well, that actually means like increase sort of the wholesome states, decrease the unwholesome states. The evil means unwholesome states, like here. So we're not really evil. But as I said on Friday night, it's really hard to engrave unwholesome states. It costs a lot more money. You need a bigger slab of marble. But evil is only four letters and very cheap. So that's why the Buddhist society did it that way. So, and the group of six monks said, "Yes, Venerable Sir," that's at the top of page 579. "Good monks, and if it were unknown by me, unseen, unfound, unrealized, uncontacted by wisdom, thus, here when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase and unwholesome states diminish, would it be fitting for me, not knowing that, to say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling?" "No, Venerable Sir." So in other words, the Buddha knows that certain kinds of pleasant feeling are counterproductive to the spiritual path. So if he says, abandon such kinds of feelings, he knows that because of his experience. "But because it is known by me, seen, found, realized, contact by wisdom, thus, here when someone feels a certain kind of pleasure, unwholesome states increase, unwholesome states diminish. Therefore I say, abandon such kinds of pleasure." And he goes to all the other combinations. "If it were unknown by me, unseen, unfound, unrealized, uncontacted by wisdom, thus, here when someone feels another kind of pleasure, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase, would it be fitting for me to say, enter upon and abide in such a kind of pleasant feeling?" No, because even if it was theory, if I didn't know it, I have no right to say. "But because it is known by me, seen, found, realized, contacted by wisdom, thus, here when someone feels another kind of pleasure, unwholesome states diminish, wholesome states increase, that I therefore say, enter upon and abide in such a kind of pleasure, pleasant feeling." So the Buddha is going to another level here. He says, even if it was just theory, I would have no right to tell you, abandon this, cultivate that. So because I've understood this, known it, penetrated by wisdom, known it thoroughly, these types of pleasure lead to wholesome states, these other types of pleasure lead to unwholesome states. Therefore I say, cultivate the first, abandon the second. And I've got a right to say that, he's saying, because I've experienced it. It's not just theory, it's knowledge. Is that clear? And the same with the unwholesome states, paragraph 9. If it were known by me, When someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states increase and unwholesome states diminish. If it weren't known by me, then I'd have no right to say, abandon that. But because I know it, therefore I say, abandon such a kind of painful feeling. If it were unknown by me, but because it is known by me, contact by wisdom, thus, when someone feels another kind of pain, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase, therefore I say, enter upon and abide in such kind of painful feeling. Even if it's painful, keep going, because the Buddha knows from experience that your spiritual growth will develop. Wholesome states will increase and unwholesome states will not increase. So the Buddha is here saying why he says abandon this, why he says cultivate that. And last in the combinations here, if it were unknown by me, but because it's known by me, contented by wisdom thus, here when someone feels a certain kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase and wholesome states diminish. Therefore I say abandon such a kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. If it were unknown by me, but because it is known by me, contented by wisdom thus, here when someone feels another kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. And I therefore say, enter upon and abide in such a kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So the Buddha is saying, he's saying these things out of experience. And especially this was referenced to eating in the evening. So eating too much, yeah, it's a pleasurable feeling, but eating too much means unwholesome states increase. Which the Buddha was saying, monks, abandon the evening meal. It's not necessary. So this was just one example of the Buddha telling his monks, his nuns, his lay supporters, please abandon this. It's sometimes pleasurable, but it leads to more problems in the future. Sometimes develop these types of pleasures because it's good for you and it creates wholesome states. So being in a religion doesn't mean that we're not going to have any pleasure at all. It just makes sure you've got the right type of pleasures. It's called the middle way. Which is why I was very, very happy to see Buddhist monasteries where you can have chairs and carpets. Because I remember the religions I used to go to when I was a kid. You had these very cold churches in England. Now this was in England where it snowed. And those churches were freezing. And there's lots of stone. And even the pews were this hard wood. There was no cushions on there when I was young. And I thought, my goodness, this is so ascetic. So you know, you can see just what we've got now. These nice cushions for everybody. Now this is like a middle way. Yeah, it is pleasurable to have nice cushions, but it leads to wholesome states. So there are some pleasures which are good for you. So the Buddha was saying, abandon those pleasures which are going to cause unwholesome states to arise. Develop those pleasures which create the wholesome states. Now, he goes on to say something else about why some monks don't really need to sort of worry too much about abandoning this or developing that, and why others do. Paragraph 11. Monks, also, is there any questions so far? Any comments so far? Okay. Monks, I do not say of all monks that they still have work to do with diligence. This is the Appamardena word, the last saying of the Buddha, Appamardena Sampadeta, to work hard, Appamardena, with diligence or with carefulness. Don't be heedless. I do not say of all bhikkhus that they still have work to do with diligence, nor do I say of all monks they have no work to do with diligence. In other words, some people still have to be careful, some people don't. I do not say of those monks who are arahats, fully enlightened, with all their taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because they have done their work with diligence. They are no more capable of being negligent. Now that's a very powerful statement. Sometimes we can read through these things too quickly. Now this is when the Buddha is teaching. It's almost he was the first person to understand a thesaurus. So when instead of saying one word, he's saying in all sorts of synonyms to make sure that people know exactly what he means. They have their arahats, taints destroyed, lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, completely liberated through final knowledge. So all meaning the same thing, but coming at it through different angles. And you can see that very often in Buddhism, especially the scriptures. Sometimes where in English we'd use one word, in the ancient texts they'd use five or six words, just to make sure that no one will misunderstand. And they're very interesting little sayings there. Arahats literally means the worthy ones. And the taints destroyed, these taints, the asavas, I like to look upon them as the outflowings of the mind. Why we go out into the world, out into the future, out into the past, out anywhere looking for happiness. The whole force of the mind which goes out to look for happiness and for meaning. That has been stopped. You find your meaning inside. Who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done. There's a meaning in life. There's something to be done. That's why you're born. Now they've done what needed to be done. Laid down the burden. Another beautiful simile of being an arahat. Because life is so heavy. You've got so many burdens to do. And the main burden is like finding peace of mind and happiness. They've done that. So the burden of life. That's why they say of an arahat, enlightened one, it's like a workman who's finished their work on a Friday. And now you've not just got one weekend, but you're retired for eternity. You've done all your work. You don't have to go back to work ever again. Oh, what bliss that would be. So they've laid down the burden. They've reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and completely liberated, free through final knowledge. They don't have any more work to do. So, but still, it says in the end, they are no more capable of being negligent. So this is not as if, now I'm enlightened, I can do whatever I want. I can have sex, I can go playing in a casino, I can go watch movies and drink a bit of beer, because I'm enlightened now, I don't need to do anything anymore. He said, no, they're no longer capable of being negligent. So an enlightened being is no more capable of breaking these rules. Why? Because their cravings have been destroyed. What do you want these things for? So that's a very important saying there. That an arahat, an enlightened being, is no longer capable of craving and being attached. It's impossible for them. But, paragraph 13, any comments about that? Paragraph, yeah. Those small rules, are they capable of breaking them? Probably not really. Simply because there can't be negligence. There's no point to it. Because most of those rules which we have are all about sort of craving for things. There are a few rules which are not so much about craving. Like even the rule I mentioned about tickling a monk. I mean, what arahat would want to do that anyway? You've got to be kind of naughty and childish to do things like that. And some of the other rules. Now, it would be possible maybe for an arahat to eat in the afternoon, you know, if he sort of, you know, doesn't know what time it is, you know, because he may be travelling or whatever. But, you know, you can't sort of intentionally break any rules. You can't call yourself negligent. So, but now you say of monks who are in higher training. Now, a monk who's in higher training, or a lay person in higher training, a nun in higher training, these are people who are either on the path to being a stream winner, are a stream winner, non-returner, sorry, once returner, non-returner, on the path of being an arahat. So this is, you entered the path, but you haven't reached the goal yet. And we'll see this in a moment. We've got these different definitions of people in higher training. I say of such monks, and this is, doesn't mean just monks, this applies to nuns and lay people too, who are in higher training, whose minds have not yet reached the goal, and who are still aspiring to supreme security from bondage. I love that phrase, because supreme security from bondage, which means freedom. And sometimes we all think we're free, but are you free? And the Buddha is saying, no, you're not free, you haven't attained freedom yet, because we are still in the prison of our cravings, attachments, our fears, and all sorts of other stuff. And it's only when we can know that freedom from desire, not the freedom of desire, but the freedom from desire, only then do we know the security from the bondage of our cravings and attachments. Remember what they always say in the English language. It's not that you own possessions, but possessions own you. So, are you free yet? So, we're still aspiring to such freedom that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when he's saying that they do have work to do with diligence, because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places, which is usually in seclusion somewhere, and associate with good friends, and control their spiritual faculties. Now, you have a word in there, I think, balance, and that is a very seditious word to put in there. You can't balance your spiritual faculties. The actual word in Pali should be control their spiritual faculties. I don't know, in your edition, have you got balance or control? Nurture. Okay, nurture is much better. I've got the very first edition of this, and I think on the second edition, myself and a few others made some suggestions. So nurture is good. And the reason we say that is because sometimes, even when I was in Sri Lanka recently, one of the monks there asked me, he said, well, we're supposed to balance our spiritual faculties. And I said, no, that's not right. And a few other monks, yes, we understand that now. The original translations got this wrong. It is not to balance the spiritual faculties. The spiritual faculties are five. Who knows what those spiritual faculties are? How many of you were at Ajahn Brahm's New Year's Eve party where we acted out the five spiritual faculties? The first one is faith, yes. The second one is, remember we chanted with Namo Tassa. It's called Virya, yes. And the third one, remember Sati, yes, remember we did the slow walking. And the fourth one, Samadhi, yes. Okay, you've got four out of five, so you can be quiet. I know you know these. The fifth one, spiritual faculty. You were there at Ajahn Brahm's party. What was the fifth question to do? Wisdom, yes. I asked you to say something profound. Those are the five spiritual faculties. Faith, or confidence, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. So you don't balance those things, you nurture them. So because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends, and it's important to associate with good people, and nurture their spiritual faculties, then they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen and women rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. And it also shows you what diligence means. He says here, they have to make use of suitable resting places, get to Jhana Grove as much as possible, or Dhammasara, or Bodhinyana, or some quiet places, associate with good friends, nurture your spiritual faculties, more faith, more energy, more mindfulness, more stillness, more wisdom. That's called... not being negligent. And then you will abide in the supreme goal of the holy life. That's why I say, this is a fruit of diligence, therefore I say, continue working diligently. Now we get to that part of this sutta where they call about the seven types of Aryans. These are the ones on the path of being enlightened or already enlightened. Now, here we go. Monks, there are these seven kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What seven? Now, when the Buddha gives these teachings, he says what the seven are, first of all, and then he explains them. They are one liberated in both ways, one liberated by wisdom, a body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by faith, a Dhamma follower, and a faith follower. Now we find out what this actually means. What kind of person is one liberated in both ways? Here's some person, I'm just going to read out what it says here first of all. Some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and his taints, outflowings are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated in both ways. I do not say of such a bhikkhu that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He has done his work with diligence. He is no more capable of being negligent. He is enlightened. Now, there's a couple of things about what's said over there. First of all, the contact with the body. Now, Ajahn Bhamali is doing a lot of work with the new translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, which will come out maybe in a year or two. And I put him onto this, and he's done a lot of work on this. Contacting with the body is an idiom. Just like the idioms we have in English, they went at it like cats and dogs. Or it rained cats and dogs. And it means it just rained heavily. It doesn't mean that cats and dogs fell out of the sky. We have these idioms. And here the idiom of contacting with the body does not mean anything like feeling it with your physical body. And you can see here, these are the immaterial states. What it means, contacting with the body, means personal experience. It means direct experience. So here, I would translate that now. Here some person has direct experience and abides in those liberations, rather than theoretical knowledge. And there is one very clear simile about this, of the two monks who were explaining that they were stream winners but they weren't arahats. And they explained, it's just like you can go to a well and you can see the water in the bottom of the well, but you haven't got a bucket and a rope to take it out. So I know there's water there, but I haven't felt it with my body. I haven't got direct experience of it. But then the arahat, he's got the string and the bucket. He's pulled the water of the rod. He's actually got the water. That's the direct experience. So when it says contacted with the body, it means direct experience. You'd even call it personal experience, but then we get into person anatta. What do we mean by personal experience? But direct experience is the best translation. So what kind of person is one liberated in both ways? Here some person has direct experience and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and the taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. Now, those liberations that are peaceful, immaterial, transcending forms, that is a very common, repeated many times descriptions of what we call the arupa jhanas, the arupa attainments. So there are four arupa attainments. Who knows what those four arupa attainments are? What's the first arupa attainment, immaterial attainment? Yes, infinite, or sometimes I like to call it unlimited space or unbounded space. And the next immaterial attainment is? Who knows the next one? Maybe if I give prizes like free membership of the Buddhist Society for the next 10 years, then maybe sort of people would actually put their hands up. That's usually what you have to do to get people to answer questions in competitions. But I'm not allowed to do that. But I will give you a free haircut if you answer this. Yes, unlimited consciousness. You get a free haircut. But it's optional. You don't have to. Unlimited consciousness. Yes. And the first, third one is the base of nothingness, yes. And the fourth one is... Ah, come on. Neither... Nor non-perception, yeah. Those are the four arupa states. So this is what they're saying here. Some person has personal experience of the arupa states. And the asavas are destroyed by him seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is one liberated in both ways. Liberated in both ways, they've got the with wisdom and with the arupa attainments. And what kind of person, paragraph 16, is one liberated by wisdom? Here some person does not have personal experience and abide in those arupa states. But his taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. I do not say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He has done his work with diligence, he is no more capable of being negligent. It's another type of arahat. And what's the difference between those two types of arahats? You have personal experience of the arupas, or you don't have personal experience of the arupa states. And that's the only difference. And if anyone wishes to check on this, the same distinctions of these, or the same type, seven types of people, is also appears in the Anguttara Nikaya. Again, good translation coming out soon. Anguttara 9, Sutta 44, where it makes it very clear that both of these, the one liberated in both ways and the one liberated by wisdom, they all have the jhanas. And it says in there, what is one liberated in both ways? They've experienced the first, second, third, fourth jhanas and the arupa states, and then their asavas are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. And the one liberated by wisdom, they have experienced the first, second, third, fourth jhanas, but not the arupas, and their asavas are abandoned through seeing with wisdom. It is not the case that this second type of person, number 16, has not got the jhanas. It says in the rest of the suttas that this is the four jhanas for 16, the four jhanas and the arupas for 15. I'm saying that because many monks have come up to me in the past and said, see, you don't need the jhanas. You know, you can actually just be liberated with wisdom without anything else. But if you read it, not even carefully, but obviously, the only difference between 15 and 16 is you've experienced the arupa jhanas. In 16, you haven't experienced the arupa jhanas. It's a technical point, but there is still some people who say you can become enlightened without any jhanas, but that is impossible. Is there any problem with that one? Okay, it's a technical point, but it does come up. Number 17, what kind of person is a body witness? Here's some person, I'm not going to say contact with the body again, has direct experiences and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcended forms, in other words, the arupa states, and some of their taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called a body witness. I say of such a person that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that venerable one makes use of suitable resting places, associates with good friends, and nurtures his spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon an abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homeless. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a meditator, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. So this is a person who can be a stream winner, a once returner, a non-returner. They're not an arahat yet. They have some of the asavas, the taints have been destroyed, but not all of them. But they have experience of the arupas. They have experience of the arupa states, but they still got some asavas left. They call that a body witness. What kind of person is one attained to view? A ditti patta. Here some person does not contact with the body, so it does not experience personally and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. In other words, they don't have the arupas, but some of their taints are destroyed by them seeing with wisdom. And they have fully understood and penetrated with wisdom the teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata, the Buddha. This kind of person is one is called one attained to view. I say of such a monk that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that venerable one uses suitable resting places, associate with good friends, and nurtures their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon the abide in the supreme goal of the holy life. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a person, I say that they still have work to do. So this is one called attained to view. And again, this can be a stream winner, a once returner, or a non-returner. But it's just, they say that some have been, taints are destroyed, but they haven't got, haven't achieved, haven't first experience of the Arupa states. So again, 18 and 17, and the only difference is whether they got experience of the Arupa jhanas or not. Still okay? 19. What kind of person is one liberated by faith? Again, here some person does not have experience of the Arupa states, but some of their taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom, and their faith is planted, rooted, and established in the Buddha. This kind of person is called one liberated by faith. I say of such a monk that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when the Venerable One makes use of suitable resting places, associate with good friends, and nurtures their spiritual faculties, they may realize arahat. And what kind of person is a Dhamma follower? Okay, the one liberated by faith, again, can be a stream winner, a once-returner, non-returner, or arahat. It's usually considered to be like the stream winner because they haven't attained the Arupa states, but they got perfect faith in the Buddha. Now we have the two types of persons, the Dhamma follower and the faith follower. And these two are those on the path to being a stream winner. These are the two ones on the path to being a stream winner. So 19, 18 and 17, these are the ones who have already attained to being a stream winner, a once returner, a non-returner, but not an arahat yet. And the two people on the path to being a stream winner. What kind of person is a Dhamma follower? Here, someone does not contact with the body, does not have personal experience of the Arupa attainments, and their asavas are not yet destroyed by seeing with wisdom. In other words, they haven't destroyed any of the asavas yet. But with wisdom, they have sufficiently gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata. Furthermore, they have these qualities, the faith faculty, the energy faculty, the mindfulness faculty, the stillness faculty, and the wisdom faculty, the five spiritual faculties. This kind of person is called a Dhamma follower. I say of such a person, they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that Venerable One resorts to suitable resting places, associates with good friends, and nurtures these same faculties further, then they can become an arahat. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. I'll just finish the next one, then we can do it. What kind of person is a faith follower? Here some person does not have personal experience and abide in the Arupa states, and their taints are not yet destroyed by them seeing with wisdom, yet they have sufficient faith and love for the Tathagata. Furthermore, they have these qualities, the faith faculty, the energy faculty, the mindfulness faculty, the concentration faculty, and the wisdom faculty. This kind of person is called a faith follower. I say of such a person, they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that person makes use of suitable resting places and associates with good friends and nurtures their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness and a full enlightenment. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. Now these two people, from 20 and 21, these are the ones who are supposed to be on the path to being a stream winner. Remember, their taints are not yet destroyed in both of these ones. They haven't, neither of these ones have experience of the Arupa states. And the only difference in them is that one of them has a reflective acceptance of the Dhamma, and the other one has faith and confidence in the Buddha. And they all have, they say, these five qualities: faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. But it seems that the person who's a Dhamma follower has very strong wisdom faculty. And the one who's a faith faculty has got very strong faith faculty. So really it depends upon the intensity and strengths of these different faculties. When it says here they have these, it don't mean they have them in full strength. They have a measure of, everyone has a measure of faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness and wisdom. The only difference is that the Dhamma follower has very, very strong wisdom, not so strong faith. Faith follower, very strong faith, not so strong wisdom. And of course, it does not mean that, you know, that they are very clearly a Dhamma follower, a faith follower. Because, oh, even the Dhamma followers have some faith. Even the faith followers have some wisdom. It depends upon which of those faculties is predominant. Now, there was three people asked questions. So, first of all, Nicholas, then Jacob, and then yourself. Yes, Nicholas. Could you please speak up? This is again, it does not mention what level of wisdom, what level of stillness, what level of energy and mindfulness and faith. So it is not mentioned there. To be able to move on from being a Dhamma follower and a faith follower, your wisdom has to be strong enough to be able to have seen the non-self, to abandon the first three fetters. And you do that either through faith or through wisdom. Basically what's happening here, if you really have faith and full confidence in the Buddha, you'll just follow what he says, which means that you will make use of suitable resting places. You will associate with good friends. That you will cultivate the mind and cultivate these five faculties. Because why do you do that? Because, you know, you've just got this incredible faith in the Buddha. No one has 100% faith in a Buddha, so you always have some wisdom. The wisdom is maybe not have faith, but you've heard these teachings. They make so much sense. You're not going on trust. You're actually going on your understanding. This makes sense. I can understand this. And you've had enough reflective understanding. This makes so much sense. It accords with, you know, my own experience and what I've practiced so far works. So that will propel you further. Because of your reflective faculties, your intelligence, it means you will try and resort to suitable resting places, that you will associate with good friends. Not because the Buddha tells you. You know what it's like to associate with stupid people. And you will sort of cultivate these five faculties as best you can. So why are you doing that? Is it because you just believe, or is it because you understand? It's your conditioning. Some people are very faithful people. And you can see that, I've got to be very careful. This was a story someone told me, that the nuns in England were being driven to an appointment, and they came to a roundabout, and the head nun, sitting in the passenger seat, told her driver, because monks and nuns were not allowed to drive a car, so we always have to have a driver. And the head nun said, "Go straight ahead at the roundabout." So they went right over the verge, through the grass, and onto the other side. Now that's faith. It's not much wisdom, but it's faith. They said that actually happened. Sorry? Blind obedience, yeah, but that's called faith. So, you know, you can understand if you had that such blind obedience, the Buddha said, sit down, meditate a lot, let go of your attachments, let go of the past and future. If you had such obedience and faith, of course you'd make a huge amount of progress. But I often say that such obedience is very dangerous. Because sometimes if you back the wrong horse, you're in big trouble. That's a very good point. I think that's why the Buddha knew the danger of blind faith. Indeed, because you have faith enough to actually do what the Buddha said here. And what do you have to do here? Resort to secluded resting places. Don't associate too much with noisy, busy people. Associate with good friends and develop these five faculties. You've developed a bit of faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness and wisdom. So that's what we're supposed to do. So why do you do that? Either you realize why you should do this and then you're a Dhamma follower, or you have faith. I'm not quite sure why I'm doing this, but you know, the Buddha told me, so it must be okay. And of course, everybody has got some faith and some wisdom. It's not just, you know, either one or the other. It's which one of those ones is dominant. Okay, Jacob. No, it does not say that at all. So you don't have to experience jhanas to be a faith follower or a Dhamma follower. Especially a faith follower, you haven't had much experience at all. You've just got so much faith. Obviously a Dhamma follower, if you've experienced Dhamma, that gives you more understanding of what the Buddha was talking about. Yes? No, they're not mutually exclusive, no, because sometimes you can be in the middle. Hard to tell whether you're a Dhamma follower or a faith follower. You've got, you know, pretty balanced, both of them. But you know, those are people on the path to being a stream. And you can see why, you know, that happens is because, you know, you've got enough faith. You know, you're not going to sort of give up until you've followed this path to the limit. You've got such faith, a person says, you carry on walking over there, just around the corner over there, you'll find an ice cream van which does beautiful ice cream. And you've got so much faith in me, and you like ice cream, you say, oh, I'm going to go over there and get myself an ice cream, especially on such a hot day. You don't know if there's an ice cream van around the corner, but you've got faith in Ajahn Brahm, so, or the Buddha, so you go there. So that's like a faith follower. And the Dhamma follower is, you know, you come here many times, you've seen actually there is an ice cream van on the corner about, you know, 4:15 on a Sunday afternoon. So you've got, you know, the reflective acceptance of that truth. So whether you do it out of faith or whether you do it out of, you know, your experiential knowledge, you know, that's why you go around the corner and get your ice cream. Faith follower will be faster, not always, because the trouble is said with faith, you give instructions, the Buddha gives instructions, but people misunderstand it. Just, you know, when that nun said, go across the roundabout, she didn't mean straight across, it means go around the roundabout, turn left, and then go across. I've done that for quite a few times. I told my driver, go straight ahead at the lights, but only when it's green. Because you know, sometimes people have got so much faith in a monk, they think they can get away with anything, and that, you know, the sort of the police, the speed camera won't catch them if there's a monk in the car. Come on, Ajahn Brahm, you can fix this for me, please. So people have got amazing faith, and sometimes it's far too much. And I've told you many, many times about the faith people have in monks in Thailand. But they always put the monks in the front of the bus. Because they believe, and this in Sri Lanka is the same, I heard. The monks always go in the front of the bus, and there's only one reason for that. To protect all the people sitting behind from a crash. Because if that bus crashes, the monk gets it first. So monks, you know, having good karma, you put them in the front and that protects everybody in the back. And I've done that many, many times, been sitting in front of the bus, and as soon as a bus driver saw me get on the bus, smiled, you don't have to pay, you don't have to pay. Because he knows he's safe. And I was going on this one journey from Chonburi to Bangkok on a big highway, and he was so pleased he had me sitting in front. I mean, really in front, just a window between me and, you know, it's a flat window. And there was a movie on the TV. It's one of these buses with a movie on. And he was so happy because now he could watch the movie and I would make sure they wouldn't crash. And he came so close, it was so scary. But that's a tradition in Thailand and Sri Lanka, always put the monks in the front of the bus. But they're very inconsistent. When you get on an aircraft, they never put you in the front of the aircraft. And I think that would be a wonderful thing if they put me in the front of the aircraft as well, because that's business class. No, you sit in the back. So that's the
the faith follower, you've got to be very, very careful. Because the faith can be into all sorts of very strange things. And you only have to look at all the different cults, you know, and weird religions people have in this world today, and just how much faith people have in wrong things, and sometimes it kills them. So be careful of the faith follower. I'm much more happier with more Dhamma followers, people who've got a reflective acceptance. But nevertheless, sometimes people have that faith, and if they do choose the right path, they can make fast progress. But it's dangerous progress. Fast, but they may be going down the wrong way. Oh yes, very much so. Oh, that's a very good question. Because if you are a faith follower or a Dhamma follower, you're one on the path to being a stream winner. So this is on the path to attaining stream winner. And it says elsewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya that if you're on the path to being a stream winner, if you really are a Dhamma follower or a faith follower, you must in this very life reach the fruit. You must become a stream winner. And in the commentaries, sometimes the commentaries which came along after the time of the Buddha, sometimes they're very weird and strange. And they say that this is such a truth the Buddha promised, if you're a faith follower or a Dhamma follower, you must attain enlightenment, you know, before you die. They say even if it is the last life of this eon and the universe is about to stop and you haven't achieved the fruit of being a stream winner yet, the universe has to wait for you. You are called one who holds up and prevents the end of the eon. I think actually what the Buddha actually meant was that when you have enough understanding of the Dhamma, or if you have enough faith to actually accept it just on the word of the Buddha, especially if you don't do it beforehand, when you die, this beautiful moment when you die, your five senses and your body are being taken away from you and you can't stop it. It's a forcible letting go. And you're just sitting there just watching this whole thing just vanish. And if you are a faith follower, Dhamma follower, you know enough about Buddhism. The Dhamma is just so clear. At this particular moment, you know, oh my goodness, the Buddha's really right. So it's usually at that last moment, which is a very powerful moment, the moment of death. If you haven't got it beforehand, you certainly will when you die. It's because things vanishing, letting go. Even though some schools might sort of make too much of that moment of death, the moment before and moment afterwards, because you all know that death is not a moment, death is a process which goes over many, many seconds. You've been with people who are dying, and you talk to doctors. And I remember the first time I was with someone who's dying, and talking with the doctor, actually, when did he die? He said, I don't know, the actual moment, second. You know, 5 minutes ago he was alive, now he's dead, somewhere in between. Because death is like a process, it's not just a moment. One moment you're alive, now you're dead. It's just the death happens over a number of seconds. So it's a beautiful thing. It's a process. It's not an event. So, but during that process, things which you've been attached to all your life, you have to let go. And that forcible letting go, now nature is taking these things away from you. It's such a powerful moment if you experience it as a Buddhist. If you're a Dhamma follower, you have enough faith, enough knowledge of what the Buddha taught and reflective acceptance, or you have enough faith that what the Buddha said was true. At your dying moment, that's how you will see death. And you will see death in such a way, the Buddha was actually saying that stream winning is a certainty. So I think that
is why the Buddha said, if not beforehand, once you're a Dhamma follower or a faith follower, you have to become a stream winner. So that's how I understand it. It's powerful. Yes, certainly you can, Che. Okay, well, this is actually a standard description, because they say here, those liberations that are peaceful, immaterial, transcending forms. Now that is repeated, that phrase, many, many times, and it always refers to the arupa states. We call them arupa, immaterial states, that's just their name. And they're all based on the jhanas. It is a development from the fourth jhana, where the mind starts to disappear, consciousness starts to vanish. So it is a vanishing of consciousness, is what actually you see through these arupa states. So when you experience, when it says contact with the body and abide in those liberations, blah, 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 what it's actually saying, you're experiencing the vanishing of the consciousness. That's why it has a huge amount of power. And the Buddha used that, the experience, the direct experience of the vanishing of consciousness, that is dividing many of these different types of stages of enlightenment. You have the first one liberated in both ways. They're not only seen by wisdom, but they've actually experienced their consciousness vanishing. And the one liberated by wisdom, they haven't experienced their consciousness vanishing, but they've seen enough with wisdom to become fully enlightened. The body witness and attained to view, these ones are similar, only difference is that one has experienced the consciousness vanishing, but not all their defilements are extinguished yet. The other one is, they haven't seen the consciousness vanishing, but still some of their defilements have vanished. The liberated by faith, they too haven't seen any of the consciousness vanishing. But because of their faith, they've actually seen enough to become a stream winner. And the Dhamma follower and the faith follower, again, these haven't experienced the consciousness vanishing. The Dhamma follower have had enough experience of the Dhamma to understand what the Buddha said. The faith follower, it just has such strong confidence that they'll accept it even if they haven't known it themselves. Okay? Okay, we'll go forward in paragraph 22. Now this is another powerful statement of the Buddha. Monks, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, final knowledge is achieved by a gradual training, by a gradual practice, by a gradual progress. So this is not sort of a sudden enlightenment, but then again it doesn't say there's not a sudden enlightenment. It's just the same way that when I go off traveling places, there is a sudden moment when the plane lands in Singapore or Hong Kong or Indonesia or whatever. But it's a gradual journey, you know, from Perth, you know, to say Singapore. So in one way of looking at it, it's a gradual process, you know, to enlightenment. But there is a moment of enlightenment as well. But the final knowledge the Buddha is mentioning here is a gradual progress, a gradual process which does have a final moment. Just like when you get your degree from university, it takes 4 years here in Australia, but there is that final moment when you dress up like a penguin with a funny hat on and you go to the sort of the convocation and this important person hands you the piece of paper in a scroll. So there is a moment, but it is a gradual leading up, gradual practice to getting to that moment. And how is final knowledge achieved? By gradual training, gradual practice, gradual progress. Here, one who has faith in the teacher visits them. And when you visit them, you pay respect to them. And when you pay respect to them, you give ear. And once you give ear, you hear the Dhamma. And having heard the Dhamma, you memorize it, examine the meaning of the teachings you have memorized. When you examine their meaning, they gain a reflective acceptance of those teachings. They see the Dharma follower, they've got a reflective experience, acceptance of those teachings. That's actually what defines the Dharma follower. But of course you have to have faith, first of all, enough confidence that these monks and nuns or other teachers you see here know what they're talking about. If you don't have faith, you will never come to see them. So you visit them, and when you pay, it's important. For that respect, it just means that you're actually listening with respect. Because sometimes people visit, they're not really respecting, they're not really listening, they're just here. So they gain respect, and when you gain respect, that's when you really listen. And when you really listen, you actually hear the teachings, you memorize it, and now the next most important thing is not just memorizing it. I'm not memorizing it. It's very easy. You don't have to memorize now because it's all written in the books or it's recorded on the tapes. So you don't have to use your powers of memory anymore. But the more important thing, you examine the meaning of those teachings. You don't just listen to them. You reflect upon them, examine them, contemplate them, poke them around and see what they mean. And once you've got and examined their meaning, then you gain the reflective acceptance of those teachings. And when you've gained the reflective acceptance of those teachings, this zeal springs up in you. In other words, you really get inspired. And when zeal, inspiration sprung up, you apply your will. Having applied your will, you scrutinize. Having scrutinized, you strive. Resolutely striving, you realize with the body, in other words, you experience for yourself the ultimate truth and see it by penetrating with wisdom. So here he's giving another way that this actually works. You know, you go and see a teacher, you listen, you get inspired, you examine the meaning, you get a reflective acceptance of the teachings, and that gives you this inspiration to practice the teachings. You've got to listen to them first of all, and then you get inspired to practice them. And when you practice them, you apply yourself, you scrutinize. Having scrutinized, you strive. So those two actually work together. Your aspiration and your scrutiny work together until you realize yourself the ultimate truth. And the Buddha says to those monks, there has not been that faith, monks. These are the two monks of the group of six. There has not been that visiting. There has not been that paying of respect. There has not been that giving ear. There has not been that hearing of the Dharma. There has not been that memorizing of the Dharma. There has not been the examination of the meaning. There has not been the reflective acceptance of the teachers. There has not been that zeal. There has not been the application of will. There has not been that scrutiny. There has not been that striving. Monks, you have lost your way. Monks, you have been practicing the wrong way. How far you have strayed, misguided men from the Dharma and the discipline. So he's scolding those two monks. Now, this actually is interesting. Even in the time of the Buddha, people didn't respect him. Look what happens next. The Buddha says, Bhikkhus, there is a four-phrase statement, and when it is recited, a wise person would quickly understand it. I shall recite it to you, monks. Try to understand it. Venerable sir, who are we that we should understand the Dhamma? Said these monks. And you know, the Buddha never recited that four verse. No one knows what it was, because those monks never wanted to hear it, and that was it, finished. So the Buddha says again, number 25, Bhikkhus, there is a four-phrase statement, and when it is recited, a wise man will quickly understand it. I shall recite it to you, monks. Try to understand. And they replied, who are we that we should understand the Dhamma? And the Buddha was exasperated. Bhikkhus, even with a teacher who is concerned with material things, an heir to material things, attached to material things, such haggling by his disciples would not be proper. If we get this, we will do it. If we don't get this, we won't do it. So what should be said when the teacher is the Buddha who is not utterly detached from material things? Well, basically, that he was saying they're not really listening to him at all. Bhikkhus, for a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is proper that they conduct himself thus. The Buddha is the teacher. I am a disciple. The Buddha knows. I don't know. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, the teacher's dispensation is nourishing and refreshing. In other words, you enjoy listening to it. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is proper that they conduct themselves thus. Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up on my body, but my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, manly energy, and manly persistence. That's the stock phrase of the Buddha. In other words, you keep on going until you find out, no matter what. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, one of two fruits may be expected, either final knowledge here and now, that's the arahat, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-return. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. At least some monks were, but these two monks weren't, because they later disrobed, as you would expect. Yes? Okay, yes. Okay. In 15 and 16, jhanas are not mentioned. The only difference which is mentioned there is whether you have arupa states or you don't have arupa states. They're both arahats. But some monks told me in the past, and said, there you go. So you don't need jhanas, because it says in number 16, because they were confusing those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, with the jhanas. That is specifically meaning the arupa states. So the only difference said here is whether you've got arupa attainments or not got the arupa attainments. But to make it very clear, the place of the jhanas in these two types of arahats, you look in the Anguttara Nikaya in Sutta 44 of the section of nines, and there you will find these two types of arahats defined again in more detail. And there you find the one liberated in both ways has achieved the four jhanas and the four arupa attainments based on the fourth jhana, and their taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. So in that definition, it mentions the four jhanas as well. And for the corresponding definition in the Anguttara passage from paragraph 16, one liberated by wisdom, there it says, one liberated by wisdom has attained the four jhanas, they have not attained the arupa states, and their taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. So in that corresponding definition, which is more full, more detailed, they say that both have the jhanas, and again, the only difference between these two types of arahats is whether they have achieved personal experience of the arupa states or they have not. That is the only difference. Yeah. That's important, because monks a long time ago, when we didn't have perfect translations of these and they didn't know Pali, sometimes I got confused. So here he actually says you don't need jhana to become an arahat. That's what they think. You don't need to have the arupa attainments to be an arahat. That's what it says. Yes, certainly, Chen. Now that's a very smart observation there. That's what it says is true. Because it says the only way people who are not sort of the faith follower and the faith follower and the Dharma follower, they haven't got arupa states. The ones with arupa states are actually there's only two with arupa states. That's the body witness, the Kayasaki, and the liberated both ways. So if you have the arupas, it says over here that you're at least a stream winner, if not an arahat. Da da da. Yeah. Correct. Because so many books are written correct. There's another interesting sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Aganya Sutta from the beginnings. And there the Buddha, quite humorously, describes the origin of books. He said that a long time ago, all the sages would meditate in the forest and they'd have wonderful meditations. But some meditators could not meditate. They wouldn't get any results from their peaceful meditations. So they moved to the edge of the forest and they started writing books. And that's where the books came from the monks who couldn't meditate. I could be very careful about that because I've written a couple of books. No, it's actually, what you said was very accurate. Well done. Exactly. What Cheng said, which was a beautiful saying, if you're not a stream, then you should stop writing books about all this stuff. You don't know what you're talking about. And it is true because there's a lot of money to be made writing books. A lot of prestige by being a professor of Buddhism in today's world. And a lot of them don't know what they're talking about. But nevertheless, we have professors, we have the intelligentsia and other people like that. But it's true. So what you actually saw there was very sharp. Well done, Cheng. It does actually show there that, that if you've got a rupa states, looks like you have to be a stream winner or above. Which is why that I know a lot of people, especially, again, going to Sri Lanka, because people are really into these attainments. I gave a very strong talk about spiritual materialism in Sri Lanka because everybody knows about these suttas and they're trying so hard to be soul ones at least that so many people say, yeah, I'm a soul one, I'm this and I'm that, and they're not. And sometimes people come and say, yeah, I've done all the four jhanas and our rupa states. I say, have you? I said, how long did you get into our rupa jhana? He said, about 10 minutes for the first arupa, 10 minutes. Oh, come on. These are incredibly powerful still states. You can't be in an arupa state for 10 minutes. No, a few hours minimum. Because they're incredibly still and peaceful. So a lot of times, because of wishful thinking, people actually say they have these states when they haven't. And what you said is very powerful and very true, and I really agree with this. You have to really be an Aryan, which means at least a stream winner, to get an arupa state. Exactly, so that's why we do these sutta classes. Just read suttas. Don't read Opening the Door of Your Heart and Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Read the suttas, they're number one. You can read those other ones just as a bit extra. But the suttas are by far the best. Yes. Okay. Now that's the jhana. Looking at the suttas, the Buddha, when he mentioned the word jhana, he only mentioned four jhanas. First, second, third, fourth jhanas. And whenever he mentioned arupa, he called an arupa attainments. He never mentioned the word jhana for the arupas. So that word arupa jhana actually came from the commentaries later on. It is not such a bad word because the arupas have to be based on the fourth jhana. If you remember some of the ways which I described these attainments, looking at the simile of the thousand-petal lotus, the first jhana there, inside the first jhana is the second jhana, inside the second jhana is the third, inside the third you'll find the fourth, and right in the middle of the fourth, it's a special case, is the first arupa. So this is a deeper going in, more things vanishing. So you're not going on to another state. So the four arupas are literally just within the fourth jhana. You can't get to them without going through the four jhanas. So they are based on those jhanas. You can't have them without the jhanas. That's just the way this whole disappearing process of will and mind occurs. Yes. Correct. Yeah. Just like the simile I gave, and
I don't know what I did with these. I gave a simile of the Russian dolls. You know, these little babushkas, and you open one and another one, exactly the same, a little smaller is inside, and inside that one is another one. I think somebody went over to Russia and they bought one of these. They gave it to me so I could use it as a teaching tool. But I don't know what I did with it. I gave it away to somebody because, unfortunately, I don't keep all these things. And I could have actually opened up. You see, this is about the first jhana doll. You open up and there's another jhana doll inside. That's the second jhana. Inside that is the third jhana. Inside that, fourth jhana. You know those Russian dolls in little pieces of wood. So that's what it's like. Is the four arupas, are they within the fourth jhana? Are they all within? They are all within the fourth jhana. They are, yes. So the first arupa jhana is in the center of the fourth jhana. And in the center of the first arupa, you find the second arupa. In the center of the second is the third. So these things are just vanishing, just like the leaves of the lotus opening out. The next layer is right within the petals you see now. You had a question?
I just earlier mentioned about the three petals.
Yes.
For the petal of the Siddhartha Paramahansa.
Yes, yeah.
The
best way of understanding that is to refer to the use of those words in other contexts in the suttas. And the funniest ones is the dog vata and the cow vata. And the cow vata and the bees and vees are interchangeable. You know what Banaras and Varanasi, bees and vees are interchangeable in Pali. So the cow vata was the person in the Digha Nikaya who practices the cow. He went on all fours, he ate grass, and he slept with the cows, and he went moo. And another man decided to have his spiritual practice, the dog duty, the dog water. So he went on all fours, barked, and eat dog food, and just lived with the dogs. And they thought that was a part of becoming enlightened. Those of you who've been to India know people do incredibly weird things in India, for spiritual practices. And this was a guy who pretended to be a dog and the other one pretending to be a cow. And they were very revered by people because it's a hard thing to do, to live like a cow, or live like a dog and eat grass all day. And so that they went up to the Buddha and they said, "We've been doing this dog duty and cow duty for such a long time. Are we going to become arahats? What's going to happen to us when we die?" And the Buddha said, I think he said, first of all, don't ask me. He said, no, come and tell us. He said, okay, you ask for it. In your next life, you, the dog duty person, will be reborn as a dog. And you, the cow duty, will be reborn as a cow. And they started crying. And it's because they'd done so much harsh asceticism for so many years, and they realized that was not the way to enlightenment. Now that's what Sila Bhatta Paramasa means. Thinking just doing these ascetic duties is enough. Just chanting rituals is enough. That's what Sila Bhatta means. Feeling that just doing rituals, initiations, chanting, or whatever, is enough to become enlightened. I mean, a good one, I don't want to offend anybody, but just going around saying Amitofu, thinking that's going to make you enlightened. That's a clear example of Sila Bhatta Paramasa. It's not the ritual, it's what you're doing that ritual for. Whether it's going to increase your five spiritual faculties, whether it's going to be following the Eightfold Path. So that's the meaning of Sila Bhatta Paramasa. Okay. So, thank you for those questions. And just to sum up the sutta, it was talking about the seven types of Aryans. Even if you're not really a real Aryan yet, but you're a faith follower or a Dharma follower,
you're on the path, you actually qualify, because it's a dead certainty you will become a stream winner either before you die or at your death. And the other three types of people are on the not fully enlightened yet, but on the way. That's the faith, liberated by faith, and the body witness, and what was the other one? The Dharma follower. And then there's the two types of arahats. And the Buddha was saying those things to show those two monks, look, if you really have some understanding, you'll be practicing these teachings, and you won't be just saying to me, the Buddha, I'm not going to do this. And you're going to be following the Buddha, because there are some pleasures which he says abandon, some pleasures which he says follow, because the difference is some lead to wholesome states, they lead to progress on the path to enlightenment, some lead to regress on the path. And the same with painful feelings or neutral feelings. Just because they're painful doesn't mean they should be avoided. Just because they're pleasurable doesn't mean they should not be followed. It depends on whether they lead to wholesome states, to more peace, more kindness, more progress on the path. And that's a very obvious but very wonderful thing the Buddha said. Follow the pleasures which lead to enlightenment and avoid those which lead in the opposite direction. Okay, so now we can give the what we usually do, we just come bow to the Buddha three times, Arahang Samma Sambuddho, to finish today's Dhamma class. And please, you can take those pieces of paper back with you to keep on your shrine if you want them. If you do destroy them, please don't put them in the bin. They should either probably be burnt. That's the only way to dispose of them. Or shredded. But please don't throw them in the dustbin with all the other rubbish, because it's teachings of the Buddha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi. Suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.